All right, let's go ahead and get started. Let me throw out a few qualifiers. I have a really good friend of mine who is addicted to the qualifier where before you talk, you give all your apologies ahead of time so as to circumvent the inevitable barrage of objections later on. And I don't think there'll be any objections, but... We now begin to venture into the commandment that probably, at least in terms of its application and thought, we just find ourselves in prickly times. And so I'm going to spend the first good section about this. But as I started working on this in the last few weeks, I began to realize there's way too much material about where we are to cover in one session. So this will actually be Thou Shalt Not Commit Adultery, part one. So if you, I'll at least give you a warning that if you don't want to talk about this anymore, then you don't have to come back to Sunday school next week. That you can make that choice. But I will say this: I'm here before you, having been in campus ministry, college campus ministry for about 22 years, some in Memphis in a rather urban context, and 12, of course, here at Ole Miss, and now the last five in a regional director context where I go around to all of the RUFs in my area, Alabama, Mississippi, West Tennessee, and Arkansas. I'm amazed how many times I say those states in a row. For about 20 campuses, and I talk to campus ministers about this a lot, about the idea of sexuality, about God's creation of us as sexual beings. But good night. Like, I don't think you have to be some sort of futurist to know that there's not a whole lot of topics that sort of whip us up into a lot of anxiety, a lot of anger, a lot of fear, and for a lot of us, a lot of shame, than the conversation about sexuality in general. I say all that to say I have zero intention, and nor is, this is not my proclivity to sort of, sort of be illicit in our conversations. At the same time, I also want to be able to venture into some places where we can speak freely and honestly like grown-ups and adults. I simply say all that because I do think that part of my desire in having this conversation is motivated by the fact that for about 22 years, a lot of the things that I see coming out of conversations I've had with college students about this topic have been motivated by the fact that they did not feel like they could talk about it here. In other words, there was nothing specific coming at them in their churches in which they grew up. And so for large swaths of fantastic biblical guidance on this topic was oftentimes kind of moved away from because we're all trying to show some decorum. Of course we're going to show decorum. At the same time, though, the Bible talks about this like a lot. And so therefore, if we get more prudish than the Bible, we've probably got a problem. So let's go diving into no adultery. That's the way the passage it reads there in Exodus 20, verse 14. If you'd like, I'm going to refer a couple of times to Genesis chapter 2, 22 through 25 as well. We'll get into that probably more next week. But if you want to have that open, I'll refer to that as well. So and remember, just as sort of a broad approach to this topic, remember how each commandment we are trying to connect to this idea of how God created us. The commandments are not just like things that God like really hates for you to do, and you know, here's his finger wagging at you. It's a very superficial understanding of how these commandments work. Rather, what they do, and the sort of tack that I've been trying to take on them, is to look at these commandments as if they are ways to open up things about you that are vital. But you understand yourself when you look at yourself in the mirror of the law. The law lets you see yourself, why you function the way you do, why you work the way you do. And there's probably not a lot of things for which you've had more sort of a struggle and experience in life than the struggle with sexuality. Well, why? Well, I'll take a couple of shots at that as to the reason why. I mean, there is no question that if you've been awake for the last 50 years, you would know that there has been almost a dizzying a sort of array of attitudes towards sexuality in general that have come up out of American culture. My guess is for most of either the parents or maybe even the grandparents in the room, The 60s and the 70s represent sort of a high watermark of the free love movement. The idea that some of the strict sort of structures that were placed over our lives, sexually speaking, in the 40s and the 50s from the Greatest Generation, in the 60s and 70s were sort of discarded as the new openness. And of course, you know, we can make an argument that that sort of hangover stuck around for a while in the 80s and the 90s until, I'm going to make the argument, the advent of the internet. The internet changes all when it comes to that point. That's the major turning point. But there was a writer for the New York Times, Alexandra Jacobs, who in 2007 published an article that basically had chronicled this culture's fascination with evolving sexual views, especially, at least in the 2000s, concerning the role of sexuality in the lives of women. What Jacobs was talking about was the way in which sexually illicit behavior, sexually risque behavior, had been reframed in the mind of women in particular from the 60s. And what she says was, if you go back into the 60s and 70s, the great argument that was coming out of the feminist movement was being deeply offended by the manner in which people had framed a woman sexually. And their argument, of course, was like what the sign says, judge women as people, not as wives who are simply there to be there for your sexual pleasure there, men. In other words, judge me as a person. You might also have them saying things to the effect of, I am more than just my body. The crazy things was, kids, college students, high school students, back in those days, women actually protested pornography. Now, the reason why I have to say that is because to that generation, that's weird. Because what Jacobs has said is something changed in the minds of women, sort of with the advent of the internet, and I could get more specific about how that time changed if you got interested in that, where instead of saying, we don't like you to sort of look at us as sex objects, the new feminism was rather trying to say, I can do whatever I want to with my body, including engage in sexually illicit behavior. In other words, if a man is able to engage in this kind of behavior, then why can't I? There were a number of books that sort of helped to chronicle this. Pornified, which was How Pornography is Transforming Our Lives, Relationships, and Our Families by Pamela Paul, is one of those sort of keep you up at night sort of reads after you look at that. And the other one that I found more interesting was written by a Jewish writer up in New York named Ariel Levy, who wrote Female Chauvinist Pigs, The Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture. And all they're saying was, is that sort of it used to be a caricature that men were the ones who engaged in the sexually aggressive, illicit behavior. But in the last 15 years, these writers have chronicled the fact that actually women have taken on that role themselves, like saying, I have the right to do with my sexual irresponsibility anything that you think you have a right to do. Behold the new feminism. This is something that a lot of you, I know that are parents, have come and talked to me about, has taken you by surprise because it was very foreign to you to find some of your sons being pursued by sexually aggressive women. You even found it sort of strange to find out that your daughters had grown up with a sexual aggression that was not there prior to. Again, I don't want to evaluate those things yet. I simply want to say, wow, the 2000s were a big change. Well, I think, if I could be a futurist for a moment, that when we get 10 years away from now, I think that we will end up saying that it by far was the homosexual agenda that has changed the most in the 2010s. There is no doubt that a lot of whatever it was that you or your parents believed concerning homosexual practice, homosexual behavior, is radically changing with a speed with which it's quite dizzying. Now, I'm going to talk much more about the topic of homosexuality, even though I'll introduce some things today that'll sort of head us up for that direction. But I need you to know that this is brand new territory. This, of course, is our nation's White House, where the head of our nation lives. And, of course, after the Supreme Court decision came down, this was the colors of the rainbow, which is a gay rights symbol has been taken from our own White House. Like, to me, that was shockingly iconic. And I'm not talking about it because of my views about homosexuality. It was just for that to be sort of put in that particular way, especially when, if the statistics are correct, 42% of Americans do not want same-sex marriage. So it's a fascinating sort of action to be taken on to 42% of Americans. But having said that, though, you have to understand that for the next generation, the ideas about homosexuality are just not what yours are. I can almost guarantee you that. I had a friend of mine once who said that every conversation I have with a high school or a college student about homosexual behavior, they talk about it a bit like in the way in which you and I talk about smoking. Some of you may smoke. That's not my discussion here today. But some people look at smoking in such a way where it's like, well, you know, maybe not the best of life choices, not exactly sure how healthy it is. But, you know, like if that's your thing, knock yourself out. I got no problem with that. That's a very close description of what the high schoolers that I talk to and some of the college students talk to. They're like, well, you know, I mean, biblically speaking, I know there's some questions there. I'm not sure I think about that. But, you know, whatever. It's a lifestyle choice. Whatever you want to do. There is an innocuousness about that particular topic that is just a jolt. Latest manifestation of this that I came across me this week. There was an article written by a psychologist somewhere in the Midwest named Joe Court. The article was called "The Bro Phenomenon and the Demise of Sexual Labeling." This was the thing behind the article. The article was introducing a new app that had been created for social interaction, which is a code word for some other things. If you've been paying attention, for the last 4 or 5 years, there's been an app called Tinder that sort of became very big among young singles in urban contexts and college students, which was a way to sort of connect with people who were interested in having a sexual tryst with you, where you would have this potential meetup. And they would simply join things. You had this little swiping things if you were interested or not interested in this particular person on the screen. And this was the way in which these things happened. Well, the bro, that is a funny name for an app, the bro allows, bear with me for a moment, men who identify as straight to find other men for whom they would like to have a homosexual sex experience together, but whom they both identify as straight people. The bro. Okay? Download it on the App Store, I'm assuming, if you'd like. Now think about that for just a second. Men who would say, if you asked about who I was, how I identify sexually, of course I'm a straight man, but, you know, if I'd like, I'd like to exercise my freedom and have a homosexual sex experience at some point. The bro. Now, don't freak out too much. This is not like made it onto the cultural level. This is somebody who wrote about it. But the last paragraph of this article, which I would actually not suggest you read, just read the summary I'm going to give, just because it's explicit in a couple places and it made me uncomfortable. And it's making me uncomfortable, I promise you. For others of you, it'll be different. He says this at the very end, and I found this interesting. He says, so given the ongoing explosion of sexual awareness rising from the basement of our cultural psyche. Like the basement. Yeah, the fact that you said that. There very well may come a time, listen, when we are forced to abandon our proclivity to pigeonhole our preferences altogether. What is he saying? There's going to come a time, he's predicting, where we're going to get rid of our desire to sort of pigeonhole people as to what you are sexually altogether, that we've got to get rid of that sort of thing, despite the unease this is likely to cause members of various subcultures. You're not talking about like Christians and religious fundamentalists. He's talking about people that want to say, I am a gay man, or I am a straight man, I am a gay woman, I'm a straight woman. That those categories will actually fail eventually. Here's what he says, and this is why I mentioned this morning. With the tectonic plates beneath our cultural psyche shifting so rapidly, we may have to learn how to maintain our balance and simply stand tall for who we are and live with the ambiguity. Okay, I think that is extraordinary for a couple reasons. Number one, he admits the fact that there are massive sort of cultural shifts going on, tectonic shifts taking place between people who struggle with this. I would say that there are few better explanations for what well-meaning sort of theologians, well-versed theologians in our day are describing what this is. There's a guy by the name of, Dan Doriani at Covenant Seminary, who came to our RUF staff training about a year and a half ago to talk about sort of interacting with the LGBT movement on campus, lesbian, bisexual, gay, transgender movement on campus. And he was talking about sort of the dominant philosophy of the day. And he says, look, the best of cultural thinkers are saying that expressive individualism is the dominant sort of philosophical idea, even though people don't use that phrase, of 21st century Americans, which basically says this: I am who I am, and no one can tell me otherwise. There will be no external constraint, either from society or from governments or from parents or authorities, which are going to be able to tell me what I am and am not. That is what comes up out of me in terms of my desires are my desires. And not only that, I have a responsibility to be that in an honest, open, and projected way. Hence, expressive individualism. It's me that's sort of on steroids. I must be free from all external constraints and be free to express those proclivities in any manner in which I so please. And so what Court ends up admitting in that little quote is, is that, you know, how in the world are you going to stand tall and be who you are while at the same time living with the ambiguities? Well, actually, I would like you to hold that thought for just a little bit, because I'm going to come back to that, because I think there's something profound in the way in which we deal with sexuality in general. And by the way, C.S. Lewis has been anticipating this for years. You know, when he wrote Mere Christianity, which would be a great chapter to go back and read in Mere Christianity about his discussion about chastity in Mere Christianity. And back in the 50s, you know, where I would say arguably there was nowhere near the sort of sexual revolution that we're having today, but he was talking essentially about what people still say today, which is, look, sex is just a normal appetite like my eating would be. And C.S. Lewis gives this brilliant illustration to say, I'm not really sure you really believe that. And the illustration goes like this. Imagine that you were escorted to another country that you've never been to and that's kind of been untouched by Western civilization. And as soon as you land in this particular land, there's a friend who meets you at the airport and they say, hey, we're all going to go out for some entertainment this evening. Are you interested? You're like, well, I guess so. So you walk into sort of a darkened sort of theater. It sort of looks a little seedy. There's a curtain up front with a stage. And, you know, slowly things get quiet as there's some sort of music that kind of comes in the background that's sort of a little alluring and sensual in its nature. And suddenly the curtain sort of gets pulled back to reveal a large plate and a steak on it. And suddenly the music starts playing, you know, as someone kind of comes in and sort of slowly cuts into the steak, you know, and pulls at the steak and starts to chew. And everybody in the crowd is, you know, either catcalling on the one hand, woo, gobble it down, you know, that kind of thing. Or they're looking back and they're, you know, sort of quietly just studying the steak, you know, trying to remember everything about it. Lewis says, imagine that for a moment. And then imagine leaving that. What you would say about that particular culture's attitude towards food. Well, he says there's two possibilities. Possibility number one is you have entered into a culture where people are starving. That was one person's explanation to Lewis for that illustration. Well, if I went there, I would think that people were starving. And Lewis actually admits that that's well within the realm of possibility. But he says far more likely would you walk away and you would say, you know what? I think there may be something about those people's appetites towards food that's going deeper than just the appetite. Because you don't dress it up with that much drama, with that much allure. You don't spend all your time thinking about it. You don't flip through.
you know, sort of internet pages, you know, with sort of sexier pictures of food.
Sorry, just thought of Pinterest for a second and, you know,
maybe we do. What is Lewis saying? He's saying that what we would say is that maybe your sexual appetites, because we do attach that kind of mania around it, are saying something more profound. So therefore, and by the way, I'm going to take Lewis's second sort of option there. Well, look, here into the midst of all of this sort of expressive individualism writ large in the 2010s, we're on the other half of the 2010s now, comes the Ten Commandments that baldly says, you shall not commit adultery. Boom. And so the rest of the Bible's expansion on this theme says that all sexual activity outside of the covenant of marriage between one man and one woman is forbidden. And look, to this generation's ears, this not only sounds like irrelevant, it sounds trite. Like, that is so cute. Like, you try to live that way? It's not so offensive as it is just precious, right? In other words, the talk that we're having this morning is just wildly irrelevant. And so what I want to be able to do in the next 2 weeks is to start to build a case. I'm going to do 2 points this morning and then 3 points next week and generally use the outline we've been using for each of the commandments. That is, that there is always a positive sense in which we can express the commandment to preserve a sexuality in this particular case. But then there's always a negative sense, which we're going to talk about next week, which are those things which are forbidden in sexuality. And to be frank with you, this one is, I think, the far more enjoyable discussion about the glory and purpose of sexuality. So those are my 2 points, the glory of sexuality and the purpose of sexuality. When you go searching for, don't go searching for internet things for glory of sexuality. Just take a picture of the Song of Solomon and put it up on your display. I never realized just sort of how much it needed to be said that the Bible is decidedly pro-sex. And this never happened to me until, I never realized this much until I got married. And I always hesitate to share this illustration because it might sound, I might be projecting something that would not be true. And that is that I came into my marriage with Ginger with what I would have considered a lot of sexual purity. I did not. I was not. But there was at least one particular activity in which I had not engaged in, which was the act itself. And I was talking about getting married with some of the other campus ministers at the Chaplains Council at the University of Memphis. I was single as a campus minister for 2 years, met Ginger. She was a math teacher then at Memphis, which is awesome. And we were sitting around talking. And so the director of the Jewish Student Union, which, crazy enough, was the guy that I had the most in common with. And I heard him describe it. I heard him describe it at one point. He said, yeah, Les and I get along better because we're the only ones that believe anything anymore. That was with like the, well, I won't mention the other denominations that were mentioned there, but there were other campus ministers in there. Anyway, Scott Ostro and I, Scott was fantastic. I remember Scott saying, man, congratulations, you're getting married in a couple weeks. I was like, well, as a matter of fact, it's like 2 weeks from now. He was like, that's awesome, congrats. And I was like, yeah, you know, it's 28 years. It's kind of a ways to wait. And just sort of threw that out as if that, I'm sure that's tacky, probably shouldn't have said something like that. But I just threw it out there, and all of a sudden, Scott just froze. This is the director of the Jewish Student Union at the University of Memphis. He kind of froze, and he goes, wait. So, like, this is your first time? And, of course, as a guy, that's not a good question to ask a guy, because you kind of freeze, and you want to be like, well, no. I mean, yeah. I mean, wait a minute. What was the question? But I just kind of sort of meekly was like, oh, yeah. And he sort of stopped, and you could see, like, it's almost like he had to brace himself and be like, wait, what? Who are you? Like I turned into a Martian in front of his face. And he stopped, and finally he resolved it in his own mind. He goes, oh, that's right. Your religion thinks that sex is evil. Now, here's the thing. Scott was not like, he was not buried in like a shoebox or something in his life. He didn't grow up in a long ways away. Like, he was a Memphian. He was a brilliant law. He didn't stay in campus ministry. Went to become a brilliant lawyer. As far as I know, he's still practicing in Memphis. Fantastic guy, but culturally speaking, when he was trying to understand the sort of cultural Southern view towards sexuality, he said, oh yeah, y'all think it's evil, right? Well, for that reason alone, I think that we need to come in and say that the Bible does not have that view of sexuality. It is overwhelmingly pro-sex. The Bible begins and ends in sexual expression. You know, it opens in Genesis 2 with naked Adam looking at naked Eve and talking about sex. You are now flesh of my flesh, he poetically says. But then we find that Revelation 19, the entire sort of culmination of human history, will finish in this experience of God's people finally being with God. Well, when God sort of gives the Apostle John an image to describe how awesome that's going to be, guess what he chooses? Marriage. And actually, honeymoon marriage. That basically there will be a giant, huge celebration of the marriage supper of the Lamb. Look, and all in between do we find the Bible giving positive views towards sex. And I'm not going to embarrass anyone, but as long as places like Song of Solomon exist, where the writer of Song of Solomon says, your stature is like that of the palm, and your breasts like clusters of fruit. Verse 8, I said, I will climb the palm tree, and I will take hold of its fruit. That's the Bible. We have a man in the midst of sex getting excited about taking hold of his wife's breasts. And to be quite frank with you, that doesn't come close to some of the other images that come from the book of Song of Solomon. All I simply want to say is we have to be very careful in the midst of a sex-crazed society to not be so afraid of venturing the topic that in our prudishness, we communicate to the next generation that we just don't talk about those things. La, 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 la. That's inappropriate. That was the word we used in our house, and I'm terrified that suddenly that's become now the label for the whole activity. That's inappropriate. I think they were being inappropriate. And what I find is, and none of you will believe me on this, but I have found in my marriage counseling, I've done over 100 weddings, but in my marriage counseling and even pre-marriage counseling, it can be just as destructive to the early stages of one's marriage to have a giant sort of gripping fear of sexuality in marriage as it can to bring into that marriage a history of sexual irresponsibility. Now, let's not do either, shall we? Neither of those two extremes are there, but it's almost as if certain Christian circles were like, well, you know, if worse comes to worse, so let's take the former. Don't do that. Can we find a healthy way to sort of look at our children in the next generation and say, prudishness about sexuality is not given to godliness necessarily? That oftentimes when we have gotten more pure than the Bible has gotten, then a little question mark ought to come up. The Bible talks about this in regular, celebratory, and beautiful and wonderful ways. You know, Keller has a funny little story he tells in a few of his sermons about sexuality, about sort of the way in which the Puritans dealt with sexuality. A lot of people look and think that, oh, you and your Puritan ideals. And they're sort of dismissive about how the Puritans, you know, sort of were so oppressive and, you know, made everybody sort of, I don't know, stay in long denim jumpers or something like that. But Keller actually drew out some article that only Tim Keller could discover where it turns out that in the 1950s, there was a guy named Edmund Morgan, who was a Puritan expert who taught at Yale University, who actually was trying to print some of the Puritan passages and sermons on sexuality, and they were banned. The school at Yale said that was too explicit. Can you imagine? 65 years ago. Why? Because what the Puritans had written about sexuality, was so racy that even the liberal establishment in the 1950s thought that they couldn't live with it. you know, those racy Puritans. All I'm saying is, and I hope you're getting used to this, that the Ten Commandments will not only reveal what we tend to think about them in, and that is, whoa, the pendulum has swung over in some sexual irresponsibility that I have never heard of. The bro app? Are you kidding? But what I'm saying is that commandment will not only reveal that pendulum swing, but it will also reveal the opposite pendulum swing to a legalism and a desire to take on the law that is equally, if not more, dangerous. I'll be honest with you. It is, again, when I just look at pure marriage counseling and I realize that my data set is skewed by the fact that I had people that were generally involved in RUF and whatever else. But by far, I had more like post-wedding, you know, first year of marriage counseling conversations with people who had come in so terrified of sexuality. Or even, it's not just from the female side, or even from guys who had been so shamed because of their sexual past that they didn't have a language to talk about their own shame. It was basically one idea, and that idea was no. It was the only idea that was sort of presented to them. Okay, so again, I throw that out there to say that that may be true for even our own marriages. I think I've been fairly surprised to find that now my responsibility is no longer with college students, but it's with campus ministers and their spouses and their families and stuff. I do more family counseling than I ever have in the last 5 years. Like, there is no magic wand of time to deal with sexual dysfunction in a marriage. In other words, there's nothing like, well, you know, after 15, 20 years, we kind of got it figured out. Did you really? I think that the seventh commandment and the opportunity to have a Sunday school about it is a time in which it ought to be at least on our radar that we're revisiting the question, so like, what's the deal? Where are we? Have we settled into patterns that may be being motivated either by even distant shame experiences from my past? Or maybe that I'm still sort of living under something where I've reacted to it too strongly. And now that I'm older and sort of my testosterone levels are lower than they used to be, I just don't want to talk about it anymore, and I'm going to place sort of yokes of responsibility on others that fail to account for that fact. It's worth revisiting. The glory of sexuality ought to be something that's regularly on our radar in all of our marriages. And is it okay for y'all to talk about that? Are you holier in your marriage than the Bible is? That would be bad. And maybe it might be time to go find someone to talk to about that, perhaps. Well, let's move on. Let's move on, shall we? Yes, by all means, preacher boy, move on. To the purpose of sexuality. Again, it searches for images. You just try to find the most innocuous. It's a girl, it's a boy. I'm just going to leave that up there. Best as we can do. Look, I think that it's easy to establish the fact that the Bible has a positive view of sex. I don't think it's so easy to explain why God gave it to us. But I don't think if you don't get this, I don't think you're going to understand why the Bible is so high on sexuality. And so what I want to talk about is sort of one purpose of sexuality the Bible does not say is legit, but then another sort of positive sort of view of how the Bible does permit it to us. And I'm trying to anticipate some of my next week's discussion on homosexuality in this particular section. First of all, why sex? Why did God create sex? Why did He create it? Well, I want to say that one purpose of sexuality that is not biblical is that sexuality was never intended to be a fundamental identity marker for human beings. That's my phrase. Sexuality was never given to be a fundamental identity marker for human beings. Sex is an aspect of our being, and because it's an aspect and because it reveals a lot about who I am, it says all kinds of truth about my identity, but in no ways does it constitute my identity. Now, I'm getting that great puzzled look from me being like, you're all worked up about this, but I have no idea why you're all worked up about it. What's the difference? Okay, I need you to go take a look and hunt down a lady by the name of Rosaria Butterfield. If there is a modern-day sort of apostle who is arguing in some of the most thoroughly biblical ways, Dr. Butterfield actually started as a very liberal, angry feminist lesbian some 20 years ago, but she became a Christian. And through her conversion, there was a change in the way in which she began to express herself sexually. Now, you need to understand something. If you say that in an academic setting. People will throw things at you. You will be eviscerated very quickly if you suggest to someone that someone's orientation can change. Okay? Try to use the phrase, and I'm not going to get the right phrase, not reparative therapy. Is it reparative? Yes, that's the phrase. Try to use the phrase reparative therapy in any academic context and see what happens. Like, I've even seen it appear in our presidential debates that have been going on. Reparative therapy is the idea that you can change your orientation. You can't do that. And it is deeply offensive to do that. Why? Because you're not allowing me to be me. I am a homosexual man, and therefore you are not allowed to tell me that I am supposed to change. That's oppressive. And if you speak against it, it's hate speech. Pray for your campus ministers, will you, by the way? Because there's oftentimes a tightrope that we walk on every single day when we stand up to sort of try to argue for a biblical sexual ethic with the cloud of simply holding our breath and waiting for the next newspaper writer who hears us say that and suddenly labels it as hate speech.
Can you put professors in there too?
And professors as well. Pray for your professors as well. Thank you, Greg. Thank you for that. Yes, for all of that, that sort of tightrope in which we walk. And now with social media, it can happen in an instant. I mean an instant. It can happen in a day. Somebody could be gone out of this thing. Now, so what Dr. Butterfield, though, is saying is, she goes, wait a minute, though. Where did you get from the Bible that your sexuality and the proclivities that you have, the urges that you have, the feelings of attractions that you have, are so fundamental that you can call them an orientation? Dr. Butterfield actually argues that there is no such thing as sexual orientation. And I'm telling you, she's about convinced me. Because the Bible simply does not describe you as a person who is born with a certain set of chemical, psycho, personality desires and things that are expressed either in a heterosexual way or a homosexual way. The Bible does not have that. And therefore, that becomes fundamental to your nature. It does not. Dr. Butterfield is basically saying, no, you are a creature who is created in the image of God. And that does not mean straight. Neither does the Bible allow me to define myself as gay. Rather, we are human beings with a heart from which flow all the issues of life, including my urges, my feelings, my actions, my thoughts, my emotions, etc. Remember the drawing that we drew during the first commandment about not having any idols? And that we have this thing called the heart, and from my heart flow my thoughts, flow my emotions, flow my choices. That's what we are. We're a heart. And we have to, only God and His Word defines me for who I am. Nowhere in the Bible does our sexuality sort of get that fundamental to us. Now, why am I talking about this? Well, a couple reasons. First of all, because I think it's clear from Jesus' conversation with the Sadducees in Mark chapter 12, verse 18 and following, that sexuality, or what we know of sexuality now, is going to change in the new heavens and the new earth. Now look, Jesus is having a conversation with the Sadducees. Who were the Sadducees? Well, the Pharisees were the religious ruling council. They were kind of the fundamentalists of his day. The Sadducees were sort of the liberals, okay? They were religious rulers, but they were sort of the liberal elite, and they did not believe in the resurrection. And so they go to Jesus and they're like, hey, I think we've got it. Hey, Jesus, you know the law of Moses that you're constantly quoting from and trying to retool and whatever else? Like, Moses said that if you've got a man who's married to a woman and that man dies, Moses commands that guy's brother to go and marry that woman so that she's got somebody to help, you know, take care of her. Well, what if he dies and then the other brother comes and takes his place? And then he dies and the other brother takes his place. And then finally the woman passes away. So, Jesus, if there's the resurrection, like, whose husband is she in heaven? You know, snicker, snicker. You know, we got it, right? First of all, the disciples loved writing stories about when people thought they got Jesus. They love it. Because Jesus looks and goes, you know what? Problem is, you're ignorant. You don't understand the new heavens and the new earth, and you don't understand the power of God. Interesting way of putting it. He says, because in the new heavens and the new earth, people are neither married nor given in marriage. Now, bear with me for a second. I remember Pam Benton, Wilson Benton's wife, doing a lecture one time that I heard where she said, I have settled on the fact that, you know, my marriage to Wilson will change in the new heavens and new earth, but I just hope that we can still be roommates and friends. And you know. Look, there's a lot of mystery surrounding exactly what that turns into in the long term, and I don't exactly know, but I think it's safe to say that there'll be a change in the way in which we think about gender and sexuality. And then he says, and you don't understand the power of God. I think what Jesus means then is that God is able to create something that is so sexually consummating that to engage in the act in the way in which you used to when you were living in the old days of our humanity will seem regressive. In other words, once you arrive in Oxford, you don't need a sign that's pointing you to Oxford. I think about this all the time when I'm driving to Oxford. It's like, Oxford, 6 miles. I'm like, ah, I'm almost home. Sexuality is a signpost that says, this is pointing to something. And once I've arrived at that something, I no longer need the sign. Does that make sense? But here's the deal. If inside you're going, oh, man, so like, sex is not going to be, I don't know. I remember when I was in high school, somebody first teaching me this and being like, oh, well, I hope Jesus doesn't come back until I get married, because at least I want to see the sign, you know? Come on. It's not fair, is it, high schoolers? Come on. Okay, so why then? Why sexuality from the Bible's perspective? Well, there's three things the Bible says. Number one, the Bible says that sex is for procreation, for the advancement of the race, the propagation of the race of peoples. Number two, it's for recreation. You cannot have a book in the Bible called the Song of Solomon and not say that there is it's okay for sex to be an enjoyment thing, that it's a delight, that something that ought to be called a delight and enjoyed for that reason alone. But the most profound reason for God's creation of sexuality is communication. That is, there is something that is being said in sexual activity to our spouses that needs to be said. And what is that thing that we're saying? The answer simply is that we are knit together. We are unified. We are together in a profound, meaningful, intimate way. In other words, sex is a profound, like incredibly personal thing where one man says to another woman in an exclusive, permanent, complete covenant, I'm still with you. I'm still here. I'm still all in. I belong exclusively and completely to you. And by the way, you know what? I don't have time to deal with that question. We'll deal with that next week. Why is this so? Because it's an object lesson. It's a signpost. Look, we celebrate a God who is himself three persons in one essence. And because he's three persons, there is relationship that is embedded in his own self-definition. That God as a Trinity has been mutually relating and connecting and enjoying the deepest of fellowship with himself from before the foundations of the earth. God did not create you because he was lonely. You know, God just didn't have anybody to love. And so he decided to create mankind so he could have a friend and bring him to heaven. No, that's an impotent God. Our God, though, actually creates out of his fullness, not out of his emptiness. I've been reading this wonderful book by Michael Reeves called Encountering the Trinity, where there's a whole book about this, that God is in his fullness creating. But when he creates someone in his image, and he's a God like that, what does that mean? It means, long list of stuff, but at the top of the list is this: you need to connect. You need to connect. And one of the most ultimate ways in which that connection is to be experienced is in this physical act of sexuality. But if that's unavailable to you, then you need to connect with another person in a friendship way where suddenly you get the feeling that you can walk away from that relationship knowing that person saw me for who I really am. They understand me. They saw the world through my eyes in this moment. I would actually argue that the desire for that connection is what sort of breeds sexuality, not the other way around. The bottom line is our sex life then becomes a way in our marriages of reaffirming, restating, and reestablishing that bond. Someone needs to write a paper, and I'm sure, you know, actually Tim Chester might have done this in that in his book, More Than a Meal, is that the name of it? About the Lord's Supper, where there's a connection to be made between what we celebrate in the Lord's Supper and what happens on the marriage bed. Look, the sacrament that we have that constitutes our relationship with God is baptism, right? That's the beginning. That's where things launch. But look, every single week of your marriage is another week that threatens to undo that bond, is it not? And not just pressures from without, but just temptations from within want to sort of work us apart. And the marriage bed is that place where we say, I know all the things that have threatened, but you know what? I'm still here. I'm still here. I've not gone yet. And I want to engage in this way, which is one of the reasons why you got to clear a little bit of the air before you engage in that activity. Because if you haven't and you tried, it kind of works in backwards. It creates the divide. It makes the divide even greater sometimes. Why? Because in the Lord's Supper, we feel the same thing. We come together and we look around, we're like, ah, oh, and it's been a bad few weeks. And we wonder to ourselves, is he still there? Is he still engaged? Is he still connected? And in the Lord's Supper, we have a sensual sacrament that actually lands on our tongue and goes inside of us. How weird, right? But this is how this God looks at our sexuality. Look, y'all, I'm going to have to stop there because I'm out of time. We'll dive into some other stuff towards the end. But I simply want to say this, that there's some wisdom for us to gain in our marriages of looking at sexuality as if it's simply a regular part of my communication with my spouse. That it's the place where I tell them that I care about them the most. And sometimes dysfunction enters into those places when it's changed from something other than that. All right. Everybody decompress. Deep breath. Cleansing breath. I left about 10 minutes for some questions if anybody wants some clarification stuff about what we talked about. Ooh, let's go back to that slide. Yes, lots of hands here. Susan, why don't you go first?
What are some practical ways to express
and make this a make sure at Sunday school we have a Sunday school topic on it at least every now and then. I don't know. I don't. When I said because they can't discuss it here, I wasn't talking about like Christ Press, Oxford. I mean the churches of the South in general. We have a sense of fear about these kinds of topics. I don't know. I feel like it, I don't think it changes unless it starts with us as parents. I don't know. My daughter's in the room, so I'm gonna put her on the spot. But like we do a lot of work in our house about saying, look, no matter what goes on, like, always ask. You'll never, ever get in trouble for asking the question, ever. I don't know. I don't know how to start with that, but that's a good question. Part of it is just being aware and knowing that there's stuff out there that sexually is being experienced and just sort of knowing it. Some of you know this better than others. Because I'm telling you, getting talked about a whole lot in high school. Wouldn't I rather be the one who sort of sets the expectations? And I'll say this. I mean, I never talked to my parents about the stuff that I was thinking. But I'll say this. And look, entertain for the second high schoolers in the room and college students. I know you think you kind of got it down. Because it's like, my parents grew up before there was all the stuff that I can view on the internet. And I've seen plenty and I know plenty, blah, blah, blah. And you may have even had some experiences. It's really different. It's really different. At least can we start, no matter where you sort of found yourself sexually at this time in your life, at least can we start by saying, I know you think you know sort of what it is, how everything works, what the issues are involved in it. Maybe you don't. Because marital sexuality is just different. It's just different. And so maybe that might open a door to one day being like, so how is it different? And I know right now. I could talk to my dad about anything. I really could. And I don't think he was unnecessarily prudish. So I don't. What was it, though, that made me not... at least ask somebody that I trusted those questions? I don't know. I don't want to put some burden on high schoolers' back that's unnatural. I'm not even answering your question now either, am I, Susan? Yeah. Somebody over here had a hand up, and I didn't see who it was. Yes, Clay. There are, from our Roman Catholic brethren, that's where a large part of that idea comes up, that I have sex in order to there to be a soul that's created, and that's the whole purpose of it. My simple argument is, then what do you do with the Song of Solomon? Like, that's my only response. Like, there's no talk about children. You know, I looked at her and thought, wow, let's go make a soul. That's not what he says. You know, but again, I recognize, look, I'll say this, in the cultural sort of fight, though, you got to, in battle, you make some battle time decisions, and I'm not sure that our Roman Catholic brothers are not our friends in a lot of this. Like, I mean, there are some chastity issues that are being argued that the Pope is taking bullets for. Whenever he attempts to teach for him. So I'm not like super hypercritical, but yeah, a celebratory view of sexuality is what I would say. Can we exegetically demonstrate that? And Song of Solomon, man, that thing's been kicked around for a while. You know, Calvin thought that it was like a 100% analogy to our union with Christ, which, by the way, is not untrue. The ecstasy of sex is to be a signpost pointer to the ecstasy that we will experience when we are finally with the Lord. Now, I know that sometimes that imagery is making you uncomfortable. Like, I don't think I need to be talking about Jesus like the way you're talking about him right now. But I mean, Paul says that. He's like, look, I am anxious for your holiness. Because if you're not, I won't be prepared to present you as a pure virgin to the Lord on the day. And we're going, all right, like, you know, just do whatever you got to do on your own. I don't think that's it. So, I mean, I just don't see the Bible delimiting it in purely a procreational sense. It's true, but not exclusively. I don't know if that helps. Yes, yes. Yeah, boy, that's it. You know, I think next week I'm going to try to sort of get into that. I'll do a little teaser. How about that? A teaser. That's not dirty, is it? I always get nervous. I'm going to say something that, like, it just sort of comes out. I think that for this generation, when I speak to therapists, plural, about how they deal with people who are going through sex addiction. This is a new thing, sex addicts. New thing, last 15, 20 years. Therapists who talk to me and the ones that I've resonated with the most have said that one of the greatest sort of struggles to deal with is to actually dethrone sexuality. Here's what they mean. They mean that sexuality is so powerful. It's like a dynamite, all right? And it creates bonds. Next week I'm going to make the argument that it actually creates bonds whether you want it to or not. Like, you don't have to believe in super glue for super glue to do what it does. You know what I'm saying? Because it's the nature of super glue to bond. Sex is the same way. It's one of the reasons why God says sex outside of marriage is fundamentally a lie. Because you're saying in an activity that God's created, we're together forever. But you're not, because this is a one-night stand. Or they're a boyfriend or girlfriend, they could break up with you on a whim. Like, it can't be. So, but having said that, those bonds that are being created tend to know how to elevate in our thinking. That sex feels so all-pervasive, it feels so urgent, it feels so fundamental to who we are, so that not only are we defining ourselves by our sexual orientation, so-called, but suddenly our sexuality, here's my phrase that I've been using for the last 6 months, becomes the only interesting thing about me. The therapists that I speak to say that the sex addicts that come into their office who are trying to get over it have got to dethrone sexuality from where it's taken its place, because suddenly it's the only thing they can think about in reference to their own struggles. Hey, look, you're not paying attention if you're not realizing that college students, this is the deal. Especially those who come up in religious circles. They come up to us for sort of help and insight and growth in this area that's like tyrannizing them. But if you ask them to think, this is one of the deals. Like, 12 years, you know, in RUF, I could say one word and have instant silence and frozen males in the room. Jason knows exactly what I'm getting ready to say. If I looked up and said, pornography, the room just went, and it was as if someone was saying, don't move. Because if he sees you blink or nudge or motion. Y'all, I said this years ago to a friend of mine. Have you ever noticed how when I just say pornography, the room just freezes? And he actually got engaged to, he's a campus minister now. This is awesome. And they were sitting on the third row of RUF. And I started talking about it. And I noticed that his fiance leaned over and started poking him and being like, and started whispering something to him. And I saw him go, shut up, shut up, shut up. Don't talk now. Anyway, sorry, that was really funny. Why? Why is that happening? Because it looms so large. Because there's so much shame. In a weird way, when I say that we've got to get out of talking about sexual orientation, I'm trying to say that as long as that is the most interesting thing about you, the only interesting thing about you, it will continue to tyrannize you. And you'll begin to attack the sin of lust. This is my other image I've been using a lot lately. You know, for a lot of guys, they come and the house is on fire, right? I can't stop myself. I can't stop looking. I can't stop the temptation. It's too strong. We've already been this far. We can't turn back. Or And what they do is they grab and they pick up what they think is a bucket of water. And it's full of shame. And they throw it onto the house to put the to fire out. But what they find is it's not water, it's gasoline. If shame is the thing that you're going to use to sort of put out the fire, all you're going to do is blaze it up more. And that's sort of my description of this generation's struggle with sexuality, is they have attempted to sort of throw kerosene and gasoline on a burning house, and all it's doing is burning worse. Because we assume that the best way to keep me away from illicit sexuality is to put a sort of wave of guilt out there that lets me know how bad I am if I do. And all I did was, is I swole that thing up into giant proportions. And the Bible's like, it's not that big. It's not that big. It's actually something much smaller. And until we dethrone that, and then I'm going to argue next week that we've got to replace that with an ecstasy that's better. Until I am convinced that there's an ecstasy that is better even than the sexual thrill that I'm getting, I'll never fully dethrone that. Or actually engage in the way in which God made us to. You can consider that a commercial for next week. All right, let me close in prayer for us, then we'll prepare for worship. Lord Jesus, we all bring, just truckloads of baggage when we talk about this issue. And so as I look out the faces of my friends, I pray that you and your Spirit would meet them in the hour to come, that as we hear, as we pray to you, as we pour our hearts out to you in those moments when we, Father, in those moments when we confess, as we sing to you, Father, would you sing us into joy this morning? Our minds get just encrusted with so many things, and sometimes we just have to sing another verse and another verse before you break in and move into our lives. So as we pray, and then finally, as we sit under the teaching of your word, would you rend the heavens and come down with a grace that would truly satisfy us? That we would see all the other things that we go to for satisfaction as being simply pointers to them. Would you do that? We pray it all in Jesus' name. Amen.